This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Let's set your Business Week agenda on, folks. Could be another interesting week. It's already a downward tone when it comes to the trade. So let's talk about it with Kriti Gupta, anchor and markets correspondent at Bloomberg. She is in our Interactive Brokers studio here at Bloomberg headquarters. Gina Martin Adams, chief equity strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence. I've been going through her research. She is on the phone in New Jersey. We're going to get to her in just a second. Quick, though, Kriti, let's talk about the trade today, because it did seem like tech tried to rally earlier on.
It did attempt. Big emphasis on the word attempt. But it's still, you are seeing some outperformance here. Take a look at this. The NASDAQ down 0.4%. Compare that to what you're seeing the S&P 500 broadly, which was down about 1% at session low. So you do see an attempt here. What's interesting to me, and I think...
Although we're pretty much just off session lows.
We are. But I think what's crucial about the tech outperformance, or relative outperformance, I should say, is take a look at what's happening in the bond market. This kind of rate sensitivity, this currency sensitivity, we're so used to hitting the tech space. You're not seeing that today. In fact, the two-year yield came in. You had an auction this morning. Nobody wanted to hop into this trade. In fact, it tailed, and the 10-year yield got a lot more volatility. So 20 basis point move on the 10-year yield, and we have yields go higher. The dollar gets even stronger. That technically should create a feedback loop into stocks broadly, and I think that's what you're seeing here.
Yep.
And that doesn't even take into account what's happening across the Atlantic.
Yeah, I feel like the UK was just, you tuned in this morning, you read the most read, and so much of it had to do about the UK. Just quickly, what do we need to know about the UK in 30 seconds?
Well, what you need to know is that this is the poster child story for monetary policy and fiscal policy butting heads. It's something that I think serves as a really big lesson for the United States. Mm-hmm. As the Federal Reserve tries to hike, do you want the likes of the Biden administration and other state authorities as well trying to give more stimulus in the face of a recession? And it's that contradiction that the UK is proving does not work.
It's tough, Tim, right? For so many people where this is they're struggling with higher prices and so on. We got to talk more, though, about the trade.
So the question is, where does one look for return when it comes to equities? Gina Martin Adams is chief equity strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. Gina, last week we talked about small caps. This week we're talking about high duration and mega cap stocks. You and the team have a new note out, but it's not essentially saying that they're standing out in a good way. It's in a bad way. What's going on?
Yeah, so when we look at the distribution of valuations in the S&P 500, a lot of great value emerged over the course of the sell-off in September. We're now looking at about 70% of stocks in the index trading below their pre-pandemic norm in terms of valuation ratios. The equal-weighted index is also trading back to its pandemic lows in terms of a forward multiple. So very clearly, opportunities are emerging in the S&P. The problem is that those mega cap stocks are still incredibly inflated. Their premium is 50% to the rest of the index, and they're high duration, long duration stocks. So that would suggest that if interest rates are going to keep rising, they're going to continue to have to reprice back to more normalized valuation levels consistent with those higher interest rates. and that could remain a source of tension in the index.
So wait, let me just make sure I understand that. So Gina, you said that various measures in terms of stocks multiples, kind of different variations, were below pre-pandemic valuations?
Yep. So 70% of the index actually now trades below its pre-pandemic average multiple. So we're looking at before the pandemic, before
right.
the valuation and massive valuation expansion, five-year average multiples pre-pandemic, so that 2014 to 2019 level, and 70% of S&P's 500 stocks are now trading at a discount to that average.
But it's not enough, what you're saying. They still need to reprice lower.
Yeah, so what's not enough is the fact that so that other 30% has a lot of the biggest stocks in the S&P 500. So the market cap weighting the index is getting in trouble here, where the biggest stocks are still premium priced.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of concentration in those biggest stocks. Most investors own them and are overweight them. The result of that is they're hanging on to these stocks that should be repricing with the rest of the index. So that creates a lot of turmoil for the index at large. You know, if you're still hanging on to stocks with a duration that is bigger or longer than the rest of the S&P 500 in an environment where interest rates are going higher, you're probably mispositioned, and the index at large is still at risk of correction.
Gina, very briefly, what about when it comes to when we start to hear from these companies, and then do we see some sort of other reset? Because after all, for better or for worse, this quarter is over this week.
Yeah, I think that we do want to look forward into October's earnings season. It's a bit early to do so yet, as we're still trading clearly on macro. You know, the interest rates are the biggest driver of equities still, with utilities and real estate stocks trading off today by the most among sectors in the S&P 500. Nonetheless, I do think we want to look forward to the earnings season and start to sort of handicap the prospects for earnings to come in probably a little bit better than anticipated, given the inflationary backdrop and the relatively steady economic indications that we're getting. As much as the market is in turmoil with this interest rate reset, the economy has been relatively resilient, suspiciously resilient, and inflation is still, pricing power is still somewhat intact for many of these companies. So earnings season could be pretty meaningful.
Got to be quick. 20 seconds. I got to ask you, we're talking about, there's a story in the Bloomberg about investors sitting on $5 trillion worth of cash, you know, ready to put to work. Does that factor in at all in terms of how you think about the outlook? And really quickly, Gina.
Yeah, not tons.
Okay.
I mean, you know, there's always a decent amount of cash on the sidelines. And frankly, for the first time in a long time, you're going to get paid to hold some cash. So the competitive landscape is very different today than it was in years past.
The CD back in fashion. Who would have thought? All right, guys, we got to run. Thank you so much. Kriti Gupta, anchor and markets correspondent at Bloomberg, along with Gina Martin Adams of our Bloomberg Intelligence.
That's certificate
team.
Of deposit, not compact disc, by the way.
Well, walk around our global cities and you're likely to see a common denominator among them. It's all in a story that is among our most read today on the Bloomberg Terminal. It also happens to be the Bloomberg Big Take, and it's about New York City's empty offices and their reveal of a global property dilemma.
The story written by Natalie Wong, John Gittleson, and Noah Buhayer. Natalie Wong joins us now. She's U.S. commercial real estate reporter for Bloomberg News. It is today's Big Take. Check it out at Bloomberg.com. And of course, an iBig Take on the Bloomberg Terminal as well. Natalie, good to have you with us this afternoon. Lay it out for us. If you take a stroll down Third Avenue in New York City, what do you see?
Thanks for having me. So we go down Third Avenue. First of all, we see a lot of empty retail storefronts, indicating that a lot of retailers are not moving in because there's not enough workers on that corridor. And then you also see a lot of 1950s to 1980s office buildings that don't quite compare to the new One Vanderbilt by Grand Central or the Hudson Yards skyscraper that we see across the rest of the city. So
what does something that's 1950s to 1980s look like? Like, is it just fewer windows? It's not all glass, that sort of thing?
It's more of those glass buildings with punched out windows that don't necessarily have a lot of outdoor spaces. You know, if you go towards Hudson Yards, you see some building, the spirals going up. They have cascading terraces around the building. But these ones, not a lot of outdoor spaces. Looks a little bit outdated when you walk into the lobby. Not a lot of amenities.
So how much of it is like in the realm of all those reality shows, it's time for a makeover for all these office buildings? How much, though, is just a post-pandemic world and not everybody's going back to work?
It's both in the sense that right now in New York City, we have less than 50% of workers that have returned back to work, especially for Third Avenue buildings. A lot of tenants have rolled over leases and are not renewing them, so there's a lot of vacant spaces left. And then it's really costly for landlords to put in hundreds of millions of dollars to renovate an entire building. It's extremely hard to do that. People don't necessarily have the funds. And then on top of that, lenders may not necessarily want to help finance that either at this point.
You mentioned financing. That's a big part of this story with loans coming due in the coming years. How does that look for the office buildings that you took a look at for this piece?
Just in general, a lot of lenders are really not keen on lending on any office buildings. Some even for Class A, let alone Class B offices that are not getting any traction at all from tenants, where, you know, landlords are struggling with maintaining costs because they have a dwindling rent roll. So it's not looking that promising for a lot of these landlords.
How much is too also a build out, like in a city like New York City? I feel like we've seen a lot of building continue, especially when it comes to commercial space. And there's just, man, if I'm looking for space, I've got options and maybe nicer options and options that make more sense for how people are wanting to work.
It's extremely competitive, I guess, for landlords, because you're right, there are a lot of new skyscrapers popping up. There's a lot of space that tenants have left behind, like really nice sublet space across even Hudson Yards, newly built out offices that these tenants aren't taking. And so people can, you know, have a look around Park Avenue, Fifth or Madison for what they want.
We're talking New York in a big way, but we do say right. This story is global. So broaden out for us in terms of what we're seeing around the globe.
I mean, this is an issue happening across every major global city around the world. In our story, you can see vacancy rates have soared from 2019 across Toronto, Frankfurt, Tokyo and Hong Kong. It's not an issue that's just common to New York.
Okay, Natalie, I'm going to ask the question that everyone has been asking for 2 years.
Uh-oh,
we have a housing
setup.
Crisis here in the city.
Yeah.
Converting these office buildings into homes, easier said than done. I mean, the windows don't open,
right.
Communal bathrooms on every floor. Like, it's a tall task. Is it something right. that is even being considered?
It's definitely being considered. People have been talking about it nonstop. But the problem right now is there is no legislation or tax incentives that makes it doable for these landlords. It's an extremely costly proposition. A lot of the buildings that could have been converted that you've seen downtown have been converted. And in Midtown, you're full of these big block buildings that don't have a lot of sunlight or air in the core. And it's just really hard to make that proposition without having any tax or financial incentives.
So enter private-public partnerships, is that what's needed? And I think about, you guys mentioned in your story about what happened post 9/11 in terms of downtown Manhattan, and we needed to see those private-public partnerships.
Right, we saw thousands of apartments spring up in place of those empty offices, and that's definitely something that people are talking about.
Because nobody wanted to work downtown, right?
Nobody wanted to work downtown.
After 9/11.
Yeah, and it really wasn't a livable area as well. And now you go down there, it's a 24/7 neighborhood.
One of the things I think about, Tim, like during the pandemic, we all talked about, especially as people obviously and had to flee their offices and then weren't coming back, are we going to see some kind of commercial market crisis as a result? I don't know that it's yet played out in the financial markets, right? We haven't
right.
really seen it, but
no,
I feel like these conversations, how could it not?
People have been talking about it for more than 2 years now, you know, with like loans coming due, how much longer can lenders extend the timeline for people? It's unclear when that's going to unfold, but definitely there's more to come, you know, in terms of the market balancing out.
Okay, 30 seconds. I'm wondering, Natalie, if the economy does start to turn for the worse and we do see a labor market that's a little softer, does it change with more people being asked to come into work?
I mean, I think we've definitely already seen an increase in people coming back to work, but I don't know necessarily that, you know, people being worried about being fired is going to suddenly turn around the entire office market. There's just too much office space and there's not enough demand.
All right. Hashtag new normal. Jay Powell says it. I'm just leaning into it in a big way, right? So many different things. What a great piece of reporting by you and our team. Natalie Wong, she's U.S. commercial real estate reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us in our interactive broker studio.
Also, check this one out online because it is very interactive and you can scroll through it. Geographically, it's very cool.
All right. You are listening, watching Bloomberg Business Week. Fall is here, which means a new docket of Supreme Court cases to be considered. Everything from the right to vote, affirmative action, gay rights, and even one involving Andy Warhol and Prince. So a variety of topics.
Joel Weber is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Greg Storr is Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News. Check out Greg's story. It's available on the Bloomberg Terminal and, of course, at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's all about the U.S. bracing for a new round of divisive Supreme Court clashes. Joel, we know the makeup of the court hasn't changed because Ketanji Brown Jackson is replacing Stephen Breyer. So it's still firmly in a conservative camp. Any surprises ahead?
Well, you're going to see more of the same. So maybe that's a surprise, depending on how you've been how long you've been watching. And that was sort of what we started talking to Greg about, actually kind of like weeks or months ago now, because we saw the last term end and we knew that there was going to be this next term. And we were like, what's it going to look like? And keep in mind how divisive last time was. So what Greg came back with was basically like, boy, if you thought last time was divisive, like this time it's going to be more of the same. So Greg, tell us what you're, as somebody who is all over Supreme Court coverage, we're going to see sessions resume next Monday. What are you watching for?
Well, as you said, more of the same. We're going to see the kind of divides, at least we expect to see the kind of divides that we saw last term. There may not be a single big case quite as big as the Dobbs case that overruled the constitutional right to abortion, but we're going to have a huge college affirmative action fight coming up on October 31st. There are a couple of very big voting cases involving partisan gerrymandering and so-called racial gerrymandering. We've got cases involving gay rights and whether people have a business owners have a free speech right to say I don't want to take part in a same-sex wedding. All these things are the kind of cultural issues that, you know, divide the country and divide the court increasingly in a conservative way.
So, Greg, what's the one that you think is going to be probably, well, to back up here, right? Like, we've had this sort of court that was a little bit more balanced in decisions. What are the decisions, you know, of the cases that you kind of just rattled off there? Where's the power imbalance start to look like?
Well, you know, you look at the affirmative action case, for example. That is actually two cases before the Supreme Court, one involving Harvard, one involving the University of North Carolina. And this case takes direct, these appeals take direct aim at a 2003 Supreme Court decision that reaffirmed that universities can use race as an admissions factor for the sake of enhancing diversity on campus. And that's something that the large majority of selective universities do. They say if you overturn that, it's going to have a devastating effect on their ability to you know, make sure there's a significant number of Black and Hispanic and Native American students on campus. That's a case where you can see this court's change of membership, the three Trump appointees who made the court more conservative. You can see that they're very likely going to make a difference. It's a case, actually, where Chief Justice John Roberts, who we know in some cases has not been willing to go as far as some of his conservative colleagues, on this issue, he's kind of been in the vanguard, saying, I believe in a colorblind constitution. The constitution doesn't permit racial discrimination, and he has suggested he sees these race-conscious admissions as racial discrimination. So, you know, the conservatives certainly go into that case with the upper hand.
What's interesting there, though, is what we learned last time is that Roberts is maybe his own man on this court, and that you've got several justices to the right of him and several to the left. And that also, you know, you have this line here that the court faces at least the specter of a legitimacy crisis, if not a full-blown one. Talk about what that means, you know, the court going its own way here and sort of the American public's reaction to that.
Well, let's start with the American public's reaction. We've seen a decline in confidence in the court, a decline in the court's approval ratings, not surprisingly, but noteworthy. That's especially with Democrats. Overwhelmingly, Democrats now say they disapprove of the Supreme Court. Over the summer, in a couple different presentations, Justice Elena Kagan, one of the liberal justices, without actually like naming names and talking about particular cases, but she talked about what, in her mind, creates a legitimacy problem for a court. And she talked about, if you have the same issue being decided a different way because the court's membership has changed. And one could certainly think about cases like the abortion case as fitting into that category. So when you have a justice on the court, at least raising that specter, it's certainly something for all of us to pay attention to.
Greg, I want to dive into the elections that a little bit and how elections could shift under the Supreme Court. What could they do specifically to make it so state Supreme Courts have a different hand in elections?
Yeah, so there are two big election cases, and the one involving state Supreme Courts has to do with a North Carolina redistricting fight. And so let me just back up for a second. You remember a few years ago the Supreme Court said, we, the Supreme Court, interpreting the U.S. Constitution, don't have authority to say that voting districts are so partisan they're unconstitutional. They said that sort of partisan gerrymandering claim doesn't fly in federal court. But they left open the possibility that a state Supreme Court could say, hey, under our state constitution, these districts you've drawn are unconstitutional. And that's what happened in this North Carolina case. And now the question at the Supreme Court, and it could be a really far-reaching one, is whether the U.S. Constitution limits what a state Supreme Court can do. The U.S. Constitution, when it talks about drawing districts and setting voting rules for congressional elections, says that the power to do that lies with the state legislature. And so the question is whether the North Carolina Supreme Court kind of overstepped its bounds in doing something that only the North Carolina state legislature can do. And this issue could apply in a whole variety of contexts, potentially including presidential elections.
Well, it's pretty wild. And when you think about personality and politics and how that potentially has definitely shaped our new Supreme Court or our latest U.S. Supreme Court. Hey, guys, we got to run. Greg Stuhr, thank you so much. Supreme Court reporter at Bloomberg News from D.C. And, of course, our thanks, as always, to the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and it is just about 10 minutes away from that closing bell. Carol Masser along with Tim Stanovic. We've got that perfect guest to talk about the market trade. I'm really curious about what he says about some of the macro trends that are out there.
Let's get right to him. Alan Lance, Director of Research at LanceGlobal.com, also President of Allen B. Lance & Associates, joins us right now on the phone from Toledo, Ohio. Alan, good to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Tim.
Okay, so we have tested and gone below the lows of earlier in the summer, or June, I should say. And now you have some strategists out there like Mike Wilson saying that we could go down to 3,400 or 3,000 on the S&P 500. He's over at Morgan Stanley. What are you seeing ahead for this year?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, because we've been negative starting the year and when we talked last month and into the rally, a nice rebound from June and August. You know, we said that we'd use that as a way to reduce exposure and risk for those that didn't sell last year at this time. You know, even though the market's plunged, you know, since then, we're still not buying. I still see there's a ceiling on valuations. There's too much uncertainty out there. I think you're going to get these negative, you know, as far as forecast now, my thought would be, what were they saying a year ago more than what they're saying today? I think that's what, you know, as far as a smart investor should really look at. But, you know, we'd be on their side right now as far as being negative, but we're far less negative than we were at the beginning of the year. If we get a big pullback, you know, sell off into October, we'd actually be buying very
similar to what we did in June. What's a big pullback? This isn't a big pullback?
Yeah, because let me just throw out some numbers. The S&P is down more than 10% since September 12th, the past 10 trading days. NASDAQ 100 down about 11% in that time frame. And then if you go to another, what I would deem maybe another key market point, the high before September 12th, which was mid-August for stocks, S&P is roughly down nearly 15% since August 16th. NASDAQ 100 is down more than 17% since August 15th. So what would be more significant to the downside?
Well, we're pretty much where we were in June, you know, and so we had a rebound. I think it was artificial. People thought inflation was cured, you know, and it was behind us. And we talked, that's definitely not the case. And that's why you want to reduce risk. Now we're back to where we were in June. The things we were buying in June, you know, getting into Goldman, you know, around book value at 270s, Chenier at 120, they're still above that, even though they're, you know, with this latest sell-off getting close again. So that's what I mean. If we saw a continued sell-off and those quality companies fell back to ranges that they were in June, then we would, you know, buy for new clients or for you know, investors that didn't take advantage of the sell-off. But it's a matter, just like in the beginning of your, Carol, being in the right areas. You know, energy has been good. It's fallen back. So that would be an area that we would get into a further sell-off.
Hey, Alan, I put out a Twitter poll, pretty basic, not any kind of high econometrics going on or SDIs or whatever. But I said financial market capitulation is close, not close, no clue. And about 38% said it is close. Do you agree, or what would denote market capitulation in your view, Alan?
Yeah, that's the problem. Is if everybody's expecting it, you know, and there are more bearish investors now than there has been, you know, in any time in recent history. And, you know, so some of the technicals are looking to a point where, you know, could see a bounce back and what have you. But I'm just saying the earnings is just so uncertain. So if you have, you know, one part of the price earnings ratio that is so uncertain, it's really hard to value. And I think that's where you're not going to get any kind of, you know, surge, you know, sustainable surge in stock valuations, you know, until some of these uncertainties clear. And that's where, you know, we'd be buying into weakness accumulating for the long term. Nobody knows where the bottom will be, but it's just a matter of, you know, we're getting close. So to answer your Twitter poll, I think we're getting close. Whether we get a big dramatic sell-off, you know, and that's the capitulation everybody's looking for, or whether it's just a sustained drop. I think, you know, we would be buying into this where 2 weeks ago we were saying, you know, I guess a lot of the media were surprised we weren't buying, and we're saying, you know, we see a further plunge. We've seen a good plunge the last 2 weeks, and I don't see anything to turn it real quick, but you know, we're definitely getting close, and we might not get the capitulation, but buy quality. And I think a year, you know, 2 years from now, you'll be happy you bought those areas, and who knows, you know, where the bottom will be. We've never been good picking the bottom, even in 2000. You know, we bought around end of November, and the market went down another four months before bottoming. So, but it was the same kind of rationale as buying Goldman at book value, and that tends to, pay off if you have a long-term perspective. You know, Chenier, right, same way. We like natural gas. You know, so the areas we're buying, I think, will do well, and it won't be as bloody as some of these highfalutin areas that still have risk to them, even though they might be down 50%. So I guess the main thing for the listeners is, you know, just because something's down 50% doesn't mean it's a bargain. And I think that's where
it can always go lower.
You're saying this on a day where we're seeing another 52-week low, a fresh 52-week low for Facebook, down to, you know, 2019 levels. Hey, just 30 seconds left, Alan. How long do you think we're sort of going to be in the midst of all this uncertainty, at least with the markets? I mean, do you see this lasting another 4 months, another 2 years?
I see it at least through the midterms, and there's just too much uncertainty. And if that, you know, clears things up a little bit, then you could see some stabilization. But if it doesn't, you know, then you know, a lot of it will be predicated on Russia, Ukraine, and some of the geopolitical aspects that are still overhanging us. So yeah, it could be a while, but nothing I see, you know, before at least midterms, if not beyond that.
Yeah, the macro risk basket feels like it's pretty full at this point. Hey, Alan, thank you so much, as always. Alan Lance, he's director of research at lanceglobal.com. He's president of Alan B. Lance & Associates, joining us once again on the phone from Toledo, Ohio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.